This is The Guardian.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. England are back, might as well just be handed the trophy after a comfortable 3-1 victory over Scotland. Duke Bellingham's good, isn't he, Barry? See also Phil Foden. And then there's Harry Maguire, poor guy. When does ripping it out of him cross some kind of line, or is it just funny? Southgate can't predict how opposition fans will treat anyone, but was there anything to gain by putting him on the pitch at a time when Scotland fans had nothing to cheer about? As for the Scots, they had a decent spell, but perhaps a sign of where they are in the pecking order of football ahead of almost certain qualification. Also today, disappointingly, we have to give some airtime to Piers Morgan's vain attempt to hold Luis Rubiales to account. We get a lovely Ellis James voice note for Latvia, a slightly less expected voice note from Tbilisi from Lars, and a revolutionary way to pick players by the Indian manager Igor Stimac. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nicky Bandini, welcome.
Morning.
Hello, Johnny Lou.
Hiya.
Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Joining us for part one, our Scottish football correspondent, Ewan Murray. It's been a while. Hello, mate.
It has been a while. So Scotland, win, and I'm not on here. And they tumble against England, and here I am. It's no coincidence, Max.
Suggesting there's an agenda. The agenda is real. Brad says, it's funny that you began Monday's pod talking about how England's matches don't matter very much now because they're going to qualify, and then spent about 15 minutes talking about what a disaster it all is. As a Toronto Maple Leafs ice hockey fan, I really relate to this. You were there. How was it?
I thought England were very good. They were buying at it. They took the game seriously, certainly in the first half, they played exceptionally well. Scotland were short of where they would need to be against a team playing like that. And that triggered the outcome as transpired. So a good night for Southgate and England, I think, all round. Bellingham was absolutely outstanding, I thought. But he wasn't the only one. England had a few exceptional performances. And I think it was even by the scale of Southgate's celebrations, it felt like a big night for him and for England. And Scotland got never a bad thing. They're, you know, a wake-up call to show them that they're still short of that kind of level of elite football.
You mentioned Jude Bellingham. Pete says, how can we convince Mr. and Mrs. Bellingham to have more children? David, in what year is Jude Bellingham winning his first Ballon d'Or? Look, Barry, he was in the right position and he was really good.
Yeah, he was the standout player on the pitch. And, you know, obviously everything has to be decided on a knee-jerk reaction. You would suggest that if fit, he has made that position his own. And if Gareth Southgate's going to start with, you know, two sitting midfielders, then the positions either side of Bellingham are, you know, there's a lot of very good players vying for those. And I would suggest on the evidence of his performance last night and his general excellence that Phil Foden would be a shoe-in for one of them. Also, you know, if he's fit. But Bellingham was just outstanding. His vision, his nimbleness with the ball at his feet, he's clearly got a great football brain. He's mobile. He can pick a pass. And on his day, there probably aren't too many players better than him on the planet, which seems remarkable considering he's only 20 years of age, and I hope his brother Job at Sunderland is half the player he is. He's already shaping up to be a decent or an excellent signing for Sunderland. Foden and Bellingham were almost unplayable last night. Rashford was good too. Harry Kane took his goal well, and it was an excellent performance from England in a game that was far more high tempo than I expected it to be, if I'm honest.
Mm. It's interesting, Johnny, that Barry talks about, you know, Foden now has to play. I'm not saying you're saying that, Barry, but sort of the way it works is if you have a good game, you have to play.
Well, I would have thought Foden should be an automatic selection all the time if he's available.
But I guess, Johnny, if Foden and Saka are playing for one role, if you play players where they play, Foden and Saka are there for one position, Rashford and Grealish are there for another, Kane will play, Bellingham will play with Madison as an understudy, even though he played on the wing, and Rice will play, and then you need another holding midfielder who's probably Calvin Phillips.
Yeah, I actually think Foden and Rashford are more, you know, they're more competing for that left wing spot, because Foden seems to play more on the left for Manchester City than he does. I think it's where Southgate sees his best position as well. So I think Foden and Rashford, because I think if Saka is fit and he is available, I think Saka is pretty much a lock in that team. He's one of those players who is essentially he's like a unicorn player. You can't really replace him. Grealish, I don't really like. And we saw last night when, you know, with Bellingham kind of ripping it up, and you know, I think we've all played in these football games where about 5 or 10 minutes in, there's this one bloke, and you all sort of, you know, look around at each other like, this guy is going to kill us, and there's nothing we can do about it. And you know, you can't really defend against him. You know, he's sort of you can't really go close into him because he turns on such a tight circle. But you can't stand off him either, because he's, you know, he can pick a pass. You can't man mark him because he kind of roams all over the place. And the key is having quick players around him, because the only way you can defend a player like Bellingham is as a team. And if you have Grealish on the left, you kind of, you know, as brilliant a player as Grealish is, he's kind of static as well. You know, we've seen with City, he's not really taking on players so much. He's not as much of a goal-scoring threat. He's not as much of a threat sort of bursting around the outside and shooting. He almost invariably passes it inside. Whereas Rashford has that threat around the outside. He has that pace. He has that pace in behind as well, which Grealish doesn't have. And the same with Foden, who can take a defender on both sides, inside and outside. So I think that's the key, because you need players around Bellingham who are going to stretch the pitch and really sort of work defences around. And when, you know, when those three are kind of passing it around, those little one-touch moves around the edge of the penalty area, yeah, it is hard to see how you defend against a setup like that. And that's the template that I think England have to really go with going forward.
Ewan, what did you make of Harry Maguire coming on and basically giving Scotland fans something to do, which was to just sort of tease the man, basically?
Yeah, I mean, what I was saying on that was, I was in the post-match press conference where Gareth Southgate launched an impassioned defence of Harry Maguire. He said the treatment that this guy has received is, he called it a joke, he called it ridiculous, not from the Scotland fans, and Southgate stressed that. He said, I've got no problem with Scotland fans and what they did. He said, but you know, he basically said this is a scenario that has been created by commentators and pundits where this guy is being ridiculed everywhere he goes. And the passion with which Southgate spoke about this was quite striking. And you know, someone said that to him, you know, you feel strongly about this. He said, yeah, I do. And it struck me actually as very good management. He defended his player so strongly. Now, you can argue it's bad management that he puts him on the pitch, but he's clearly struggling a bit, and he scores an own goal. But at that point, England were so much in command of the game that Gareth Southgate could reasonably think, you know, putting on Harry Maguire is not going to change the outcome. And it didn't change the outcome. But it was the post-match comments and how vehemently he defended defended Maguire, and all that's happened around him that was, you know, it took me aback how strongly he seems to feel about this. And I'll be honest, I haven't paid enough attention to it to know whether Southgate has a point and whether this has all been over the top and out of order. But it's rarely in the modern age you see a manager who goes so far out to defend a player. I don't know, but has it been over the top the way this guy has been portrayed? I don't know if Southgate has a point or not, but he clearly feels so, so strongly about this.
I don't know, I don't know what you think, Nicky. He feels, you know, he's the latest Man United meme, isn't he? Like after Phil Jones. And there's a sort of feels like there's a tipping point. I don't know, like, you sort of, I actually found it funny that the Scotland fans are just cheering him doing very rudimentary football-based things, just passing it to whoever was next to him. But when he scored that own goal, I did go, oh, mate, that's not, that can't have happened. You can't be serious.
Yeah, I suppose in my head there's different ways of protecting someone, aren't there? There's protecting someone by sort of being out front and speaking publicly and saying, I'm, you know, with this guy, and continuing to pick them as a way of sort of proving that point. But I wonder if Harry Maguire almost at this point does need the opposite kind of protection, which is taking him out for a little bit so that he's not getting that. Because I think whether or not it's about Harry Maguire as a player, I think exactly as you said, Max, when you're the focus of that much fan attention, when you're getting that much sort of additional pressure in effect from just knowing that the people, even the opposing fans, are sort of sending you up in that way, I think it can't be a good spot for him in terms of his mentals, as we talk about in football. I think it can't be doing him good to be knowing that he's become this sort of lightning rod and this sort of figure of ridicule, because there is obviously a good footballer there. You don't end up at Manchester United in the first place if you aren't, but he has made high profile mistakes and this was another one.
Yeah, Johnny, I mean, I guess there's this kind of, I don't know if it is a fine balance between taking the piss out of players and a player's mental health. And it sort of ends, what happens is it's kind of fine until the player himself says, actually, I'm having a really bad time. And then everyone looks back and goes, oh, we shouldn't have done that. And then life carries on and we take the piss out of other footballers, because when footballers make mistakes, it's kind of funny in a non-personal way, I guess.
Yeah, and these things are part of the same, you know, it feels a bit like a vicious cycle now. And it almost doesn't matter whether Harry Maguire is getting ridiculed because he played badly, or Harry Maguire is playing badly because he's been getting unfairly ridiculed, because it's become part of this snowball effect that the only way to out of it is really to break the cycle somehow. I mean, he really should have left Manchester United during the summer. I thought there's no earthly reason why he should still be playing central defence for England. It felt like a really cruel twist of fate that he scored that own goal. But if you have a defender who can sort his feet out quicker, who can get into a better position, who can get across quickly enough to clear the cross with his right foot rather than trying to tap it away with his left, then you know that end up in that position. So at a footballing level, he's clearly being exposed, and that is just feeding into the cycle of ridicule and outrage, and then Southgate coming in and feeling like he has to go all in on defending him, which I found fine. You know, he's your player. You know, you've staked a large part of your managerial identity almost on this guy. But it's interesting, you know, when Southgate is asked about, you know, England get racially abused in an away fixture. Well, you know, there's both sides. You know, there's two sides to it. We need to look at ourselves. You know, what about, you know, Jordan Henderson in Saudi Arabia? Well, you know, it's a complicated issue. Like, what about Harry Maguire? This is a line in the sand, and I will not stand for it. I found that very interesting. And it's obviously great that he's standing up for his player, but I feel like this is kind of a side point, but we're getting into the late Southgate era where he's getting cranky and defensive and the siege mentality and is basically seeing enemies anywhere. And that is never a good place for a managerial reign to end up in.
Yeah, Maguire finds himself in this weird position where he's playing football for two different managers, one of whom doesn't rate him at all and the other rates him far too highly, I think. And I couldn't agree more with Johnny. He definitely should have gone, left Manchester United during the summer, tried to rebuild his career at West Ham, where I think he would have probably been really good. And I don't know, what was that decision based entirely on money or some other reason? He can't genuinely think that he'll be able to force his way back into Erik ten Hag's plans unless there's, you know, a serious injury crisis at Manchester United.
I mean, there is a serious injury, and he's still not quite, you know, getting back in. And I mean, interestingly as well, like Mark Gay played well, Lewis Dunk actually played really well yesterday, and then Tomori has yet to really get a look in, Nicky. And I wonder if you're surprised about that.
I think with Tomori, it's kind of an interesting case, because his best football he played at Milan so far was in his first season at Milan. The first season he was at Milan, I think it's a travesty he didn't get an opportunity with England. I think he was playing really, really well. He was thrust into this leadership role when Simon Kjaer got injured, and he had Kalulu coming in alongside him at centre-back, and he rose to it, and he was brilliant. But it was interesting because I remember talking to Stefano Pioli, who's the Milan manager, at the start of 2022, and he said that the one thing he'd like to see more from Tomori is for him to be like a fraction more patient. He said Tomori's so much quicker than the average defender. He can afford to take an extra fraction of a second before making his decision to commit to something. And if anything, I think in the last year, Tomori's got worse at that. I see him jump on plays, trying to anticipate something and getting it wrong and finding himself out of position. And he hasn't had last season such a clearly strong season. It was an up and down season. And there were a few moments where he was getting caught out for exactly what Pioli had identified in him. This season, obviously, he's only just started. He did get sent off against Roma in the third game. So on the one hand, I think the case for giving Tomori his moment is less strong than it was, like I say, a year and a half ago, maybe. But at the same time, do I think he deserves a chance if Maguire's getting a chance? Yeah, why not? Why shouldn't he?
You mean, from a Scottish perspective, I mean, it's nothing to be disheartened about. You know, winning in Cyprus was much more important than this. They had that little spell. So when Ryan Christie came on, they sort of took it to England for a bit and the atmosphere got great. And that sort of, in a way, led to the goal. But it's fine, isn't it? They know where they are in the general hierarchy of football.
I think so. And Steve Clarke is very keen on never getting too high, never getting too low.
Man after your own heart, Ewan, I would say.
Yes, very much so. Well, certainly never getting too high. No, but I think in the grand scheme of things, of course, Steve Clarke doesn't want the team to lose. He won't enjoy defeat, but I think he maybe won't mind that reminder that this is where we are in big picture terms. I think possibly in hindsight, he played the same team that played in Cyprus on Friday, where it was baking hot, where they dominated the ball. I think in hindsight, he should maybe have changed a couple of players. Christie is one of them, actually, who I would have played to maybe get at England early on, run at England. He didn't do it. I think the key was winning in Cyprus. The key is qualifying for the Euros, which I'm still very confident they will do. And I said at the start, I thought England were very, very good in the game. And when they were at that level, it's very difficult for Scotland to cope with them. Never mind the Scotland, they probably played at 60, 70%. They weren't quite at it. So, yeah, no need for despondency yet.
Yeah. You wrote a really good piece on the quality of the Scottish national team absolutely not reflecting the quality in the SPL recently. Because, you know, someone who doesn't really follow it might think, oh, well, Scottish football, Scotland are good, Scottish football is currently great.
Yeah, I think that's a dangerous assertion, and I think when things are going so well for the national team, which is now, I think that's a time where people should look at the league and say, right, what can we do better? What more can we do? I think the standard is poor. I think the number of Scottish players in the league, and I know this is replicated elsewhere, other countries, Belgium's a good example. You know, the best Belgian players don't play in Belgium, but I think the Scottish Premiership and clubs within it have to do more to promote and develop Scottish players. And bluntly, I don't think they're interested. I think winning trumps all in that domestic environment, and I don't think it helps Scottish players. So, as you know, I'm Steve Clarke's biggest fan. I think the national team has done wonderfully well under him, but I think there's a bigger picture in terms of Scottish football that isn't altogether rosy. And I think that now is probably the time to look at that when the national team is succeeding, because inevitably Steve Clarke will leave or things will change and the national team will struggle, and that's the point where people will say, well, you know, what's going on here? And I think you should look at it when things are going so well for the international side.
Johnny, how does this end for England? I mean, you can sort of see, I think you're absolutely right about cranky Southgate. It's something we haven't really seen before. Like, he's always been very measured. Can you see him, you know, England could win the Euros and then he could really go off in a blaze of glory and a kind of fuck you all, I've done this, you know, Harry Maguire on his shoulder sets fire to Wembley and you see finally we see the real Southgate. I'm not a suit anymore and that's it. Gets in a Harley Davidson and we never see him again.
No, I was going to say, they should win the Euros. Never mind, could. They should win the Euros.
Yeah, but I mean, it is England.
I don't think they should win the Euros. I mean, they're obviously one of the teams that can win it, but you know, France, Spain, Italy, I mean,
Italy have to qualify first.
Italy have to qualify first. I mean Portugal look very good at the moment. Is there anybody who wants Southgate still to be manager of England, including Southgate himself? It's such a, I don't know, it seems like such a joyless cycle. This was always the danger after Qatar. Everyone say, oh, he must stay because, you know, he's done such a great job, you know, the lads love him. But the danger was that we'd end up in this kind of this, you know, this kind of late Southgate stage where you are essentially, everyone knows this cycle is going to end, and everyone's sort of slightly, well, Southgate's clearly positioning himself for his next job, which I reckon might be in Saudi. You know, you read the runes, you know, the sort of the slight ambivalence over, he goes over to Al Ittihad or somewhere and immediately signs Maguire, Pickford, Ashley Young, Eric Dyer, you know, and he recreates his team of champions out in the Gulf. That seems like he seems like a guy who's beginning to pivot away from England. This is his one last mission, his one last task. He's going to try and focus everything on winning the Euros and then leaving in a blaze of glory. That's clearly the end game here. And you know, it may well work out like that. But I just can't see it. I don't think England have the all round depth to win a major tournament. I mean, they have kind of two okay goalkeepers. They have massive holes in defence. They still have a bit of a puzzle in midfield, and then of course they have this wealth of options up front, which is what everyone looks at when they think, well, you know, this is the greatest generation of players that England have ever had. You know, we should be absolutely destroying everyone. Everyone should be, you know, should be kneeling at our feet. But actually, if you look further back, England are not an elite side.
But Johnny, which of those things weren't true when England went to the final of the last Euros, and this is before you have Jude Bellingham in the mix as well?
Well, yeah, they've overperformed. They've performed very well, and Southgate has done an incredibly good job of getting them to World Cup semi-final, they've seen with a poor squad, you know, final of the Euros with a pretty decent squad, and I think it was about a par performance in Qatar. But, you know, it's clearly, we're coming to the end now. It's 7 years. It's a long time to have the same guy in this job. They need some kind of fresh messages, some fresh players, some fresh tactics and hope almost. That's what I don't think we're going to get in this cycle.
I think I agree that this about the freshness needed. I disagree that this idea of the squad depth, I mean, it's sort of, to say it that way, mythologizes the other teams in Europe. Like, oh, of course, these teams are all flawless when they're not. I mean, Spain haven't even won all of their qualifying group games. These other teams that England are up against are not perfect squads with two players for every position. I think that's false.
I mean, there's one perfect squad in France, and the rest are sort of, you know, kind of, that they all have gaps to fill.
That's why I think England should win the Euros. I think all these other countries, I do agree, France aside, I mean, even Scotland beat Spain. I think all these teams have issues that England don't apparently have. I think the England squad, and I'm not a huge Southgate fan, but I think the England squad and team is massively strong.
Ewan, before we end part one, I don't know if we'll speak to you before the Ryder Cup. Can Europe win that? I really love the Ryder Cup.
Yes, I think they will win that, actually. I mean, the US haven't won in Europe since 1993, and the Ryder Cup is massively home team based. Really, the home team generally wins. So,
have we got any? And we have got no live players, have we? Or have we let? What's happened with? Are they in or not in?
We don't have any. No.
Ah, but there's
Brooks Koepka's playing for the US,
Yanks too.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Even. Okay. Good. Come on, Europe. Yeah. Barry, you're sort of looking mockingly at me. Do you not love the Ryder Cup?
I watch it, but isn't Luke Donald is the European captain? And then he's got, 27 vice captains? Because you need a lot of vice captains just to send 12 golfers out to play in a particular order. But he picked Shane Lowry, the Offaly man. I'm not sure that was a great idea. Hopefully Shane will prove me wrong. Yeah, I find all the golf itself I like watching, and the rest of it, Christ, it's just sick making.
I actually agree. We've had a thing this week where the European team went to Rome on a scouting trip, and it's forensically analysed and detailed. And I agree with Barry. It's 12 plus 12 of the best golfers in the world. It shouldn't be that complicated. It shouldn't need all this work and preparation and detail and analysis. I think that's become a little bit out of hand, actually.
Thomas Bjorn once had a pop at me at Twitter for making the point that the Ryder Cup was, you know, is there really any need for all these vice captains and, you know, support staff? Just one bloke to pick 12 names out of a hat. You know, off you go, lads. But what would I know?
Thomas is not a man to fall out with. That's all I would say, Barry. Watch your back.
Oh, grummy. I'm amazing if Barry was murdered by Thomas Bjorn with a 7-iron. What that would do, that would get some
That would be quite the Scandi...
would, wouldn't it?
Scandi
noir.
What do you call it? Detective drama.
The Killing, Series 4. Thomas Bjorn, like a blood-soaked Thomas Bjorn, hacking at Barry Glendenning and anyone that stands in his way. Anyway, we must end part one. Ewan, you can go now. Thanks for coming on, mate.
Right, take care.
That'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Italy's win over Ukraine.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. John says, could the next live show halftime spectacular be Philippe taking on a hotel buffet breakfast, the natural sequel to Steve Claridge and the bowl of fruit? Today's panel, of course, first on the team sheet, Nikki and Johnny, who are going to be with us in Brighton, the last show, the finale on the 22nd. Benji says, keeping in mind that we're coming to see Football Weekly live in Brighton straight after Baz and Max have done two nights in Dublin, will we be watching two dehydrated, incoherent husks alongside the heavy lifting of Lou and Bandini? And I will be on fine form. About 20 tickets left for Brighton. It's going to be live streamed around the world. So, wherever you are, come and watch that. Ireland's now totally sold out, as is Bristol. Tickets still available in London on the 13th of November with Ellis, Troy and Philippe, and me and Barry. And on the 15th of November with me, Barry, John Bruin and Nader Manuaha. If you want tickets, go to theguardian.com/FWTour23. Link is in the description as well on the website. Italy 2, Ukraine 1. This is going to be a much bigger game than the Scotland-England game and a massive win for Italy.
Yeah, they needed it. I was watching on the Italian coverage on Rai and... they called it uno spareggio per evitare gli spareggi, which means a playoff to avoid the playoffs. And it felt like that. If Italy had lost this game, they would have been really behind the eight ball in Group C, having already obviously lost to England. They drew just a few days before away to North Macedonia. If they'd lost this game, you would have been Ukraine on 10 points already and Italy back on 4. So losing it was out of the question. But even drawing it would have put them in a tough spot. So really huge and important game to win at San Siro, and they did. I would say it was quite firmly deserved, but at the same time, it was a go 2-0 up, concede a goal before halftime, and never quite get that third goal that would have put things into a safe spot. So there was a little bit of nervousness right to the end.
Two goals for David Fratesi, who I may never have heard of before he scored these two goals. Who is this man? Has he got like 100 caps and 80 goals?
Not at all. It's Davide Fratesi.
Davide.
No, not at all. But I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about him. He moved from Sassuolo to Inter this year. He had a really good season at Sassuolo last season. Scored 7 goals for them. He hasn't started yet for Inter. I think he's come off the bench in all 3 games. And he didn't start or indeed play at all in the game that was drawn against North Macedonia just a few days before. And I think it's going to be one of the really interesting components of this. A lot of people in England might not follow what's happened with the Italian national team in the last month. Roberto Mancini, of course, who English fans will know from the Premier League and Manchester City, but who also managed Italy to win the Euros in the last cycle. He resigned, giving the Italian Federation about 20 days to prepare for that North Macedonia game, in which they hire Spalletti. And he's thrown straight into this qualifying group where the situation is very sort of in the balance. And his first game in charge was a North Macedonia game, which they drew. And in that game, his starting midfield was Nicolò Barella, the Inter player who is the one consistent across both two games, But the other two were Brian Cristante and Sandro Tonali, of course, at the Newcastle midfielder. In this game, Cristante and Tonali both came out, and Fratesi came in together with Manuel Locatelli, the Juventus midfielder, and the balance of the midfield looked much, much better. Fratesi was really impactful, not just with the goals, but Spalletti plays this 4-3-3 and he likes to have box-to-box running from his midfielders. He likes to get on top of teams with that press early in the game, and he did in this game. And both of Fratesi's goals were very much opportunistic. The first comes from a mistake by the right back, which the ball's worked to Fratesi very quickly. He takes a shot first time into the bottom corner. The second one comes off a deflection. So he is a goal-scoring midfielder. He is a line-breaking midfielder. He is someone who will make those, will get those opportunities, punishing mistakes and convert them. But no, he's very much someone who Inter are excited about, but we haven't seen much at club level yet this season. And throwing him into this game, this critical game, given that he hasn't started yet for Inter this season, was a gamble by Spalletti, but it was one that was really rewarded.
So look, they're in a good position now. They've still got to go to England, though, and Ukraine don't have to. So I guess it's in Italy's hands, is it?
So Italy have a game in hand. Italy, Ukraine, North Macedonia, all on 7 points. The thing that, as you just said, Ukraine have in their favour is they played England twice. So of those remaining five games, they don't have to play the best team in the group again. And Italy have the return game against Ukraine, which is in Ukraine. So those two things work in Ukraine's favour.
Or probably in Poland.
Actually. Yeah, of course. Sorry, probably, of course. Yeah. Those two things work in Ukraine's favour. But on the other hand, head-to-head is used to decide tiebreakers. Italy do have that extra game in case they get anything out of England. It's in Italy's control again, is the biggest thing. I think if they had lost this game, it would have been that feeling of this is spiralling out of our control. We no longer have a possession of our own destiny. And as I was just saying, these two games felt really perilous because Spalletti had only been in charge for 20 days. He'd come in the middle of a qualifying campaign that hadn't started brilliantly and been told, fix it. And yes, he's just won the league with Napoli. He's a brilliant manager, but that's asking a lot, especially of a national team manager, where you don't have the time to work with your players and get to know them, to come up with solutions right away. Italy still have lots of problems. They haven't got a clear choice up front at number nine. Ciro Immobile scored in the game against North Macedonia, but no one really believes in him as the team's number nine. They started with Raspadori in this match. And again, you're talking about a player who doesn't start at club level. Raspadori doesn't start for Napoli because Victor Osimhen's there. But the team looked much better because plays more like a false nine. He vacates the area and he created the space for those midfielders like Fratesi to get into. So there's still a lot of questions, but at least now Spalletti has an okay platform on which to go away and start making proper plans.
Yeah, I mean, not qualifying for two consecutive tournaments would be...
Well, it would be 3 out of 4, with one in between, you know, winning the whole thing in between.
Winning one, yeah. I mean, that is winning one is quite good, sort of thinking about it. The Paul Pogba story is a massive story out of Italy, isn't it? He's been provisionally suspended from playing after a drugs test found elevated levels of testosterone in his system. Italy's National Anti-Doping Tribunal said Pogba was tested after Juve's 3-0 win at Udinese on the 20th of August. His agent, Raffaella Pimenta, said she was awaiting the second sample and cannot have an opinion before the results. What is certain is that Paul Pogba never wanted to break a rule. What's the reaction been in Italy, Nikki?
Yeah, I mean, of course, everyone is very much in this sort of wait and see phase, exactly as you've just said, Max. Players have 3 days to request the B sample to be tested. And then I think it's 7 days, up to 7 days it takes for that the results to be returned from that. So we're waiting on the result of that second sample. I think there's a mix in Italy of sort of, I think there's some part of the reaction has felt like it's almost this grim sense of inevitability that the Pogba story isn't going to end well. Obviously he came back to Juventus a year ago and there was quite a lot of excitement when he came back about this sort of Pogback moment and everyone remembering what a brilliant player he was at Juventus. And I do think some people have forgotten quite what a brilliant player he was in that first era at Juventus under Antonio Conte. And this being the spot where he could reclaim everything that he was. But the steady sort of never-ending injury issues coupled with, I suppose, the various horrors he's gone through off the pitch, which things that nobody should have to go through, like being kidnapped and threatened and all of these things, that there was just this sort of, I don't know, inevitable move towards a not great conclusion. There's another part to the reaction in Italy, which is, look, Juventus, having made that investment in bringing him back a year ago, have not been getting what they wanted from that investment. They had been trying to negotiate to reduce his wages already. And there are some people looking around and going, well, if, and let's reinforce that if, because we're waiting for the B sample, but if this ends in a suspension for the player, if it ends with a guilty verdict for doping, that allows the club, under the terms of the collective bargaining agreement between players and the league, it allows the club to unilaterally cut his pay packet. So there's a part of the reaction which is, well, wouldn't this be actually quite convenient for Juventus if it happens, given that he's not playing anyway? So I think there's a lot of wait and see still, but that those are two sort of aspects of how this could play out. Also, the other sort of story that's been cited a lot in Italy is the case of Palladino at Atalanta, who was suspended for failing a drugs test. And then in the appeals process, 4 months later, had that overturned and is now back playing for Atalanta. So there's still lots of outcomes on the table at the moment, I would say.
Nicky's right. If you just go and watch, I mean, look, lots of footballers' highlights reels are good, but his highlights reel at Juventus before he went to Manchester United is absolutely incredible. And he's, you know, he's 30, and you sort of, it just shows you like how you can be brilliant for a while and then your career doesn't go on perhaps how it should for lots of different reasons. Let's go back to the qualifiers and to Latvia. Latvia 0, Wales 2. Ellis James sent us a lovely voice note. I don't know if any of you have listened to it, where he, his Hello Max, I think when I first heard it, I thought, he is absolutely shit-faced. And then actually, he appears to be more sober. I was sort of slightly disappointed because he actually, in this voice note, will give some actually good analysis of the game. So here it is.
Hello, Max. I am outside. I don't know where I am. I'm in Latvia. And I'm about to go to a bar called Sound Factory. We won 2-0. My God, this team needed a win. We won 2-0 away from home and kept a clean sheet, which is extraordinarily rare. I was talking to the friends of mine who I'm out with. My friend Quion has done 29 Wales aways and has seen us win 4 times, which is a win ratio percentage-wise. I don't even want to work that out. But anyway, we won 2-0. I thought we looked very bright in the first half. Also, Jordan James, who is still incredibly young, obviously, and plays for Birmingham City, seems to be filling an enormous Joe Allen-shaped hole in our midfield, which I think could be really, really significant. I talked to Oshan Roberts, who was our assistant manager, and Coleman and Guy Speed, obviously, as I was our assistant manager when we got to Euro 2016. And he could not speak highly enough about Joe Allen. Like, Joe Allen is a big miss for us. And so Jordan James, not that you want to put an enormous amount of pressure on him, he did seem to settle us down in midfield, which I think is really, really important. We scored 2 goals. That's fantastic. I just think that I was listening to Radio Wales on Saturday, and Nathan Blake said, this team just needs to win and it needs to get a bit of confidence. And if we are to qualify for Euro 2024, it's almost certainly going to be through the playoffs. I would be absolutely stunned if we do it, you know, by finishing in the top two in this group. But we've done it. We needed to win away from home. And I think, and obviously we did that. So it's great. We've now got, you know, Armenia away, Turkey at home, and Croatia at home. It's eased the pressure a little bit on Rob Page. And I think a lot of our fans have made their minds up about him. But he did what he needed to do. I thought Ramsey, especially in the first half, was very good. Oh, my God. It's just, that's all he wants us to win. I don't really care how we win. I just want us to win. But I thought today looked a little bit more positive. Can I just say, I've always admired your work, and I think you're very nice.
Thank you, Alice. It also finished with a compliment, I think, for me. And I don't usually get them, so I appreciate it.
You're my best face, Max.
It was along those lines.
I've done the maths, by the way, and or the math. And just he can let his friend know that he's on his travels following Wales, he's seen them win 13.79% of their games.
Ah, excellent. Well, it was not totally convincing, but a win is a win. Great to see David Brooks scoring, as it was to see him scoring in the Premier League. Ben Fisher was also at this game, and he has an amazing story about it, which will be debuted at the Bristol live show for those of you lucky enough to have a ticket. Right, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with that Luis Rubiales interview he did with Piers Morgan, which was broadcast last night.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Luis Rubiales interview, we'd seen some clips of it, but the whole interview was broadcast, his chat with Piers Morgan. What did you make of it, Barry?
Well, I thought it was simultaneously remarkable and also thoroughly predictable. It's quite telling, I suppose, that Luis Rubiales has been in the news in Spain for weeks, but he's given the interview to a British journalist on British TV, at times speaking English himself, at times with the help of an interpreter or translator. And I mean, he got a very easy ride from Piers, which is no great surprise because Piers Morgan has... We know what Piers Morgan is like. In the past, he's called women who participated in a march in Washington after Trump's inauguration. He referred to them as rabid feminists. So, you know, Lewis was always going to get a fairly easy ride from Piers, and that's ultimately what happened. They focused entirely on the manner in which he kissed Jenny Hermosa, but they didn't put it in, there was no effort to put it in any sort of context. So people watching the show, and I think Piers Morgan has a pretty pitiful viewing figures, but those who were watching who weren't familiar with the story will have no idea of the background of the 15 players who stepped down from duty from the Spanish national team because they couldn't bear playing for Rubiales's mate, you know, the manager who he kept in employment. And, you know, if you're not giving people anything close to the whole story, then what is the point of doing the interview? It was hopeless.
Didn't understand why this thing needed to happen. Did we need this? Do we need to hear more from Luis Rubiales? I think that's the whole problem, is that we've been hearing too much from Luis Rubiales. That, you know, should we not be platforming some of these rabid feminists who he's been employing for the last, you know, few years? The whole problem comes when, you know, powerful men get the platform to say whatever they want in front of other powerful men, or in this, you know, in this case, a large suckling pig with an apple in its mouth, and on some minor cable TV channel. You know, nobody needed this, and I think we shouldn't really be showering this with any more attention than it needs to be showered with, to be honest. I think it's a bit of a grotesque spectacle. I won't be watching it, and I would advise you not to either.
I don't have much to add to what those two just said, because they've said it. I think I'd be angry about it if I hadn't spent so much anger on this story already. It was a pathetic non-interview. I think, while on the one hand, I would empathise with lots of people saying, no, I want to do this interview in my first language, I did think it was also very convenient for Rubiales that by doing the interview, replying in Spanish, it meant that Piers Morgan couldn't do what he normally does to all his interviewees, which is interrupt them and talk over them. He can't do that when he's having to have everything translated back to him. So even more so, just allowing Rubiales to tell exactly the story he wanted to tell, exactly the story we've already heard from him 100 times, repeated extremely repetitively for an hour and a half. It was, yeah, it was pointless, not contributing to the conversation around the situation at all, in my opinion.
Also worth having a read of Susie Rack's column about it, because which has been echoed on this podcast, but it's an excellent piece of writing. Go and do that. To Tbilisi, for some reason, Norway beat Georgia in Norway. It's a key game in Scotland's group. Jaw would have guaranteed Scotland's qualification. Lars Sivertsen volunteered a voice note. He was in Tbilisi in Georgia for reasons that really aren't clear and to which he gives no explanation.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Lars Sivertsen here, reporting from Georgia, I guess. I've just watched Norway beat Georgia in a bar in Tbilisi, in the country of Georgia. Of course, the game took place in Oslo. So I watched Norway beat Georgia in Oslo, but I was in Georgia. This sounds like a scheduling mistake, which it wasn't. It's just, there's really never a bad time to go to Tbilisi. It's a tremendous place. Norway are not qualifying for the Euros. We've kind of messed things up in our group, but this, at least we won a game, which was nice. Erling Haaland scored a goal, which was nice. Martin Ødegaard looked good. He had some moves. That was nice. But I think the big takeaway from this, which I would, in all seriousness, want to bring to Football Weekly listeners, aside from go to Tbilisi, because it's great, but Antonio Nusa, I think, is a real player. And I'm not a little bit behind the curve here. Other people have said so before me, but he's a young 18-year-old Norwegian winger playing in Belgium now. He made his sort of proper game for the national team, this, and two assists, looking really sharp, lively, like a good old-fashioned dribbly boy out wide there. So if we can add a dribbler to Martin Ødegaard, to Erling Haaland, maybe we have a team. But, you know, still worry about that defense. But we won a game, which is exciting. Bye!
Thank you, Lars. Germany beat France 2-1. Rudi Völler was in the dugout, and he started Thomas Müller, which, if you told me was what Germany did in 2010, I would have believed you. Müller put Germany 1 up. Sané scored another one. Griezmann got one back. But that's a nice bounce after Hansi Flick. Shimmy says, where's the love for Japan? Back-to-back wins over Germany. Looks strong against Turkey. Players in top teams all over Europe. Would anybody like to give some love to Japan? Johnny is doing some love mimes. I don't know if love mimes is a thing, but like, it seemed nice. does sound sinister. Does sound like something you could make a lot of money on the internet doing, love mimes, doesn't it? But anyway. The MP was suspended after it was found that he had been performing love mimes when he should have been carrying out important work in his constituency. Christopher says, subject, Luxembourg. I hope you're happy. Cheers, Christopher. We dedicated some time on Monday's pod to Luxembourg's incredible run so far in qualifying. They then proceeded to lose 9-0 to Portugal that evening, which follows us saying Georgia were quite good, and they've since been gubbed 7-0 by Spain and lost again. Carl says, after snubbing Paul Watson for the live shows, why are you snubbing him again? Delivering the biggest news in world football this week, British Virgin Islands winning their first game for over a decade and their first competitive game since 2004. They beat Turks and Caicos Islands 3-1. I think the manager of British Virgin Islands is someone that you wouldn't expect it to be, but I can't remember who it is. Hang on.
Mel Gibson.
It is not. Oh no, it's not. I mean, I don't know. I've never heard of them, so it's not. It's not Mel Gibson. But that would have been a surprise. Chris Kiwamia. And Danny Glover together. Is it Chris Kiwamia?
It's Chris Kiwamia.
It is somebody else, right? That didn't come up on my. Oh well, I just googled British Virgin Islands manager. I didn't get football. There you go. So I didn't get.
You probably got a wealth fund manager or something.
Yeah, I did. Chris Kiwamia is not running wealth funds in. Well, he may be as well, but who knows? But yes, Chris Kiwamia, big win for him.
Frank Lampard reportedly on Lyon's managerial shortlist after Laurent Blanc got sacked with the bottom of Ligue 1, so that'll be fun to follow. We mentioned the Scunthorpe-Buxton game getting called off in the 96th minute with Buxton winning 2-1. The National League have announced they will have to replay the fixture in full, which is slightly harsh. And Saka says, do you think Southgate picking Henderson is based on astrologers' advice? Did any of you see this story about Igor Stimac, who is the India manager? And some really detailed reporting, I think, from the Indian Express, that he's basically asked an astrologer who he should pick on numerous occasions, giving like full details of their birth, you know, giving their date of birth and what position they play. And the astrologer going, nah, tomorrow's not a good day for him. And actually following the advice, which is absolutely sensational. Do you have any thoughts on that, Barry?
No, it's kind of a harks back to, who was that France manager who was very into birth signs and signs of the zodiac and had lucky numbers and stuff. Well, it didn't end well for him. Anyway.
Was that Noel Edmonds? He had lucky
numbers.
Wasn't
it Dominic?
Oh, yes, Dominic. I mean, if it works for you, I see no harm in it. Seems odd, but...
I think it didn't work for Dominic.
No, it did. His reign ended very, very badly, old Raymond.
I used to do the overnight show on BBC London. You'll remember 2 till 6 a.m. It's a fun gig, and we used to have astrology for 2 hours on I can't remember which morning it was. I was incredibly tired, as you can imagine, and people would ring up and say, "Look, things aren't going so well." I remember a caller ringing saying, "Look, I'm in finance, but my career isn't going so great," and this, you know, and said, "Look, I'm a Sagittarius," and the nice lady was saying, well, your node is in Neptune and this might mean, you know, you're at the wrong company. I was like, this person listens to me between 2 and 6 every morning. And I just said, look, I don't want to lose listeners, but maybe just go to bed and get some sleep. That might actually help your career in finance. Gary says, if England are in fact a bechamel sauce, as Philippe suggested on the last pod, they are in fact what legendary French chef Georges Auguste Escoffier would classify as a mother sauce in terms of classical haute cuisine. This would suggest that England could actually evolve into any number of derivative sauces, with adding some Parmesan, Gruyere cheese and Phil Foden, make them more dynamic sauce mornay. Or perhaps Southgate should opt for butter, caramelised onions and James Madison for a rich, velvety soubise. Just some food for thought. Thank you so much. Fraser said, we're really running into the weeds now of last international break pod. Fraser says, I just had to rescue my dad out of an elevator in Sardinia. I was thinking to myself, has Barry ever been trapped in an elevator? And if so, what did he do about it?
I haven't ever been trapped in an elevator, is the answer to that question. And if I was, I presume I would look up, and invariably in movies, there's a panel that you can remove and then climb out of the elevator and crawl through an air vent in your vest and bare feet and then blow things up. So that's probably what I would do.
Yeah. I mean, presumably, you'd be running away from Thomas Bjorn holding a... you know, some kind of machine gun.
I think I do recall one member of staff at The Guardian, quite an important news journalist, who apparently got trapped in an elevator for quite some time, and he didn't have his phone with him. And he was needed for some very urgent deadline to finish some article. And it looked like he just vanished off the face of the earth. And I think people kind of assumed he'd just gone to the pub or something. But no, he was stuck in an elevator.
I was thinking you could just press the call button before climbing up and blowing things up.
Yeah, well,
it's a sensible idea. But, you know, whatever floats your boat. But anyway, that'll do. I don't know. I don't mean that, do I, really? I mean, definitely do what Nikki says. Really? I don't think anyone uses this part as advice, but that would be the best bit of advice. All right. Is this a self-help pod? I don't think it is, isn't it? That'll do for today. Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Barry.
Thank you.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.